This is chapter 10. I said that we had finished chapter 8, but it's chapter 6, but it occurred to me that it would be very useful for me to show a sort of worked example there of using things like the relativistic Doppler shift, just to so you can see them having been done once. We'll then move briskly on to chapter 7. I think we won't get all the way through chapter 7 today, but so we will encroach, I think, on lecture 11. But I have high hopes that we'll get into chapter 8 next time. Any questions about organisation material, anything like that? Okay. What I wanted to, there's an example I wanted to work through is the case of, imagine a relativistic ambulance is going past you, and you see, or it's going past at a relativistic speed, and you see its blue light, you see its blue light as it's passing you. What frequency is the light? So the way we'll work that out is using the essentially the recipe that I, or some approximation of the recipe that I mentioned in chapter 5, talking about the Lorentz transformation. What we do is we talk about the two frames. So let's have our x primed y prime frame. That's in the frame of the ambulance. And that's moving at some speed v, and the light in that frame is being emitted at some angle theta prime. So this is the frame with the ambulance. Okay, and we want, the question is what is the the light has frequency f primed. Okay. And the question is, what frequency do we see that light in our frame? And our, so what is f in the frame in which the ambulance moving at speed, and that would of course be neater if I were handing this in. At that point, once we've set the question up and been clear and explicit about what the frames are, what we have been given, theta, what we've been given, we will give ourselves an f prime and a theta prime. Once we've set it up correctly, the answer almost pops out, almost automatic. Is that the expression for the relativistic Doppler shift? F equals f primed. Gamma f prime 1 plus v cos theta prime. So the question, if this were a question in an exercise or a question in a test or an exam, the question would then be, if the light were emitted perpendicular but to the ambulance, what frequency would you see it as? And what that is that's telling you what theta prime to use, what angle to use. Now, if I say the light is emitted perpendicular to that, the light you see, the flash you see, that we're looking at the frequency of, is emitted perpendicular to the ambulance. What is that telling me, anyone? What bit of data that we know that we need is that telling me? Is it telling me F? It will be double shifted, yes. But the light that's emitted perpendicular to the ambulance's the ambulance driver just shines out the window. Is telling us, is it telling us theta or theta primed? Theta primed, exactly. So it's telling us theta primed, not theta. So the light emitted perpendicularly to ambulance is at or minus pi by 2, whatever. Theta prime equals pi by 2. In other words, cos theta prime is 0, and so that f equals gamma f prime. In other words, even though this light is emitted perpendicular to the direction of motion, so where classically there would be no Doppler shift, it's blue shifted. Okay. That might seem slightly surprising. Why is that slightly surprising? That fits in with you know that Doppler shifts blue shift things. But why is that slightly surprising that f equals gamma times f primed? It's surprising because the time dilation, the ambulance is moving at a relativistic speed. Therefore, you'd expect time to slow down, frequency to be lower. So you'd expect f to be lower than f primed. Anyone any ideas why that seems to be the wrong way around? Let's ask a different question. What would I? How about what is the light of the frequency? What is the frequency of the light that I see when I look directly across the path of the ambulance's motion and see when I see the light come in directly in this direction, what different? How is that different? How is that a different question? They're the same two frames. So it's the frame of the ambulance is moving what in this direction, say with positive v, and I'm in this frame. The same two frames, same speed, but how have I changed the question? In the first case, I talked about the not f and f primed, but theta and theta primed. So in the first case, I was asking what is the frequency that I see of the light that's emitted perpendicular to its motion by the ambulance. Now I'm asking, what is the frequency of the light that I see arriving perpendicular to the direction of motion of the ambulance? And they are not the same thing. Because in the second case, the light observed perpendicular is at theta equals pi by 2. And if I look at something like f primed equals gamma f 1 minus v cos theta, if theta equals, which is the counterpart to this going in the other direction, if theta is equal to 0, it's a pi by 2, then cos theta is equal to 0, and f primed f primed over gamma. And in the first case, if theta primed is equal to 0, then cos theta will be equal to, well, v, some number which is less than 1, so the light will come in at a different direction from pi by 2. And if, looking at that the other way around, if cos theta was 0, because I'm looking at the light I'm observing from this direction, then the counterpart of that, that light was emitted in a different direction by the ambulance. And that's why the light that I'm seeing arriving perpendicular to me, that's nicely redshifted because of time dilation, blah, blah, blah. As opposed to the light which is emitted perpendicularly. I'm making a fuss about this, not because you have to care very much about observing the colour changes of ambulance lights, but because I have asked two different questions in that example, which are different questions. They were carefully worded, and I would word them more carefully if we were setting that as an exam answer. But in both cases, the thing you had to work out was, what does he mean? Which, does he mean theta or theta primed? I was talking about theta prime is pi by 2, or theta is pi by 2. If I'm talking about light being emitted forwards or backwards, is that theta equals 0 or theta equals pi, and vice versa. So several of the exercises are essentially questions of interpretation. How do you read the question and turn it into which, so that's why it's like the recipe that I talked about for doing Minkowski, for doing Lorentz transformation things in chapter 5. Step one is writing down, being clear and explicit about what the frames are. Step two is writing down what you know, what you've been told. And that's the non-trivial step, going from what the question says to, that means it's that figure, theta prime or whatever that I mean told, and not theta. And toward the end, you're turning the handle, you're just plugging things into expressions. So that's a rather... slightly hand-wavy question there.
Yeah, I'm not sure. The diagram at the top.
Yeah.
There's like a straight line, and then there's the wave coming out.
Yeah.
The angle there is not shown to be pi over 2.
Oh, no, not in that example. No. So that's more general. So in the case that we're talking about, that would be in the x prime, y prime. So there it's. Is that case? Okay. So yes, I drew the general diagram first, and then particularized it, given the information in the question. Okay. And again, not very pretty, not very neat, but good enough for talking over. Any other questions about that? There are half a dozen, I think, questions in the exercises in chapter 6, which are variants of that. Okay, right, then let us move on. And we can talk about dynamics. Okay. Kinematics, I said, was about describing motion. Let's stick with that for a moment. Kinematics is about describing motion. Dynamics is about explaining motion. So dynamics is where we talk about forces and momentum and so on. The stuff that you learn, you're thoroughly schooled in terms of Newtonian mechanics. In the kinematics chapter, we talked about relativistic velocity. So we'll go back onto this one. We talked about relativistic velocity and its slightly unusual properties. Now, we are very familiar with how we get non-relativistic momentum from velocity. We just multiply it by a mass. So let's do the same. Let's define a thing P, which is just the momentum of an object is its mass times the speed of the object. So there's a velocity 4 vector, there's a momentum 4 vector. And the mass here is just the mass. I mean, there's nothing complicated about the mass. It's how much how much material there is when you hold it in your hand. Okay, and the mass doesn't change. The mass is just a number. It's a Lorentz invariant. That's so far so good. That is nice and simple. But we remember that in the case where the particle is not moving, its velocity will be a four vector pointing along the time axis. So it has its time component is 1 and its spatial components are all 0. In that frame, the P will be equal to M, 1, 0. So P dot P will be equal to M squared, which is a Lorentz invariant. So that's the length of the momentum four vector is just the mass squared. The length squared is just the mass squared. And that's true in every frame. So because this is a four vector, in different frames, this momentum will have different components. They're nice and simple in the frame in which the thing is not moving. But in other frames, the time component will be bigger, the spatial components will be bigger, and so on. But when you work out the length squared of the object, it'll be m squared again, as before. Because that's the Lorentz invariant. The length squared of the vector is frame independent. Okay? Now, imagine we've got some a couple of quick questions there, which I'm not going to talk about. Imagine we've got a collision like this. So there's two particles come in and two particles come out. So it's not a very exciting collision from the point of view of particle theory, particle physics, but it's nice and simple from the point of view of our analysis of it. Two particles come in, P1 and P2. Something happens, and two particles come out, P3 and P4. Now we're going to make a wild guess and suppose that P1 plus P2 equals P3 plus P4. We're going to suppose that four momentum is conserved. We know that three momentum is conserved in non-relativistic collisions, and you do know that, I trust. And we're just going to suppose that the same is true for this thing we've got here. We've no evidence for that. That's just a guess, because we like doing that with momentum. At the moment, it's just a guess. Okay. So what does that let us do? That's an equation between four vectors. So it's true component by component. And what that means is that so P here will be P1, for example, will be M1 gamma 1 V. If I look back at the slightly strange notation that I mentioned in the other notes, just to show you that you have seen that before, it's just this, with an M in front of it. Okay? And written down component by component, what that means is that gamma 1, M1 gamma V1 plus M2 gamma V2 equals M3 gamma V3 plus M4 gamma V4. And all I'm doing there, just writing out longhand, the x component of the expression above. So that's just the x component of that vector equation above it. So as you can see, So that is I've written that wrong, incorrectly. There should be a V in each of these, V1 V3, V4. My note, so equation 7.2b in the notes should have V's in throughout. And that is just P, essentially gamma 1, P1 plus gamma 2, P2 equals gamma 3, P3 plus gamma 4, P4. In other words, that is just the spatial components of this recover the normal conservation of momentum just with some extra gammas in here, which, of course, in the non-relativistic case, are all approximately 1. So this this relativistic expression, conservation of relativistic momentum, is consistent with the conservation of ordinary spatial momentum in the limit when gamma is 1, in other words, at slow speeds. So this isn't saying anything different from what you're already familiar with. Okay? Mumble, mumble, positive mumbles? So much for the spatial part. Now, if we look at the time component of that, what we see is that the if we look back at this expression here, we see that the time component is. I'm going to switch away briefly from the conservation momentum and look just at the time component of our four vector. So if the overall thing is m gamma 1 v, then the time component, the zeroth component of this four momentum, of this four vector, is just gamma m. Right, that's not surprising. All I'm saying is that's fairly obviously the time component, the zeroth component of that expression. But we might then think to ask, what's the low speed limit of that? Can we find an interpretation for this zeroth component of this four momentum? Yes, we can. Because if we look at the low V expansion of V, so that using a Taylor series, then gamma, which is equal to 1 minus V squared to the power minus a half, is going to be 1 plus V squared over 2 plus things of order V to the fourth. So that is going to be M plus a half mv squared plus terms of order v fourth. And that is, I hope, a rather suggestive expression. You've got something in there which goes like a half mv squared, which looks a lot like the kinetic energy of the particle. And what that hints to us is that if momentum is conserved, four momentum is conserved, then each of the components is conserved, and we saw that with the spatial momentum. There's a hinting that there's indicating also that this zeroth component is conserved in collisions, and there's something there that looks like energy. So that's prompting us to interpret this zeroth component of the four momentum as the energy of the moving particle. So the spatial components correspond to the spatial momentum that we're familiar with. The zeroth component corresponds to the energy of the particle. Sort of, but it's clearly not the energy we're familiar with, because there's a half mv squared in there, but there's also this m. In other words, this is telling us that this thing that is a bit like the energy of the particle, because it's conserved in collisions, isn't zero when the particle isn't moving. So when v is equal to zero, that reduces to just P naught equals m. And if we look at this expression here, P naught, and we're going to write that as E, we're going to sort of jump to the conclusion there, is equal to gamma m. This, remember, is in the units where c is equal to 1. So we can ask, what is the version of that expression in physical units when c is not equal to 1? So we can do that conversion. We can put c back in and make sure that with the right power so that the dimensions work in physical units. And we get gamma m c squared and the zero speed limit of that, where gamma is equal to 1, E is mc squared, which has been called perhaps the most famous equation of the 20th century. So what we've done here, so this seems, E equals mc squared, we've got that, as I'm sure you hoped we would at some point. But all we've done here is guess that by putting an m in front of the relativistic velocity, we've got a thing which we're calling the four momentum, which is physically meaningful. We are reassured that it's physically meaningful, because when we decide to say, let's suppose that the four momentum is conserved, then we get, first of all, something which looks like the conservation of three momentum, or which reduces the conservation of three momentum in the low speed limit. And we've also got something which looks a bit like energy, which we decided to call energy. So this P naught is what we are from now on calling the energy of the particle. And the fact that we're giving it that name is plausible, because we spot that expression for the kinetic energy in there. And we discover that it's non-zero when the thing isn't moving, and recover this E equals gamma mc squared. In other words, as far as relativity is concerned, as far as the dynamics of relativity is concerned, the energy that's important is not the kinetic energy, the first order term in that expression, but the whole thing, which is non-zero even when the particle is stationary. So there is energy in mass. And by the way, all this reassures us that we are right to say this four momentum is conserved in collisions. And that is the third example of a physical statement that I've made in this course. The first two physical statements were the first two axioms. The expression of Galilean relativity, you can't tell you're moving. The second axiom, everything moves at c. Those are things that could be otherwise, but I'm saying that in our universe, they appear to be that way. The other things we've done in the last 10 weeks have been logical consequences of that. So they can't be otherwise. If you take those axioms as true, the other things just follow. This conservation of four momentum is another physical statement. You can imagine that being otherwise, and it wouldn't be mathematically wrong for it to be otherwise, but in our universe, it appears that's just true. Okay? And that's a statement about physics, or astronomy, or whatever you want. And it's important to be clear about the distinction between those two things. There are more things I want to say on that section. So what that also means is that you can see here that this is the zeroth component of this gamma mc squared is the zeroth component of the four momentum. And that changes, that's a frame-dependent thing, so the spatial components of the four momentum and the time component of the four momentum are different in different frames. So the spatial momentum of a particle is different in different frames. That's not surprising, because that's true in non-relativistic physics too. But also the energy of a particle is different in different frames. The energy being the zeroth component of four momentum. But always. So energy isn't a thing you can ascribe to a particle anymore. But what you can notice is that what will still be true is that P dot P will be m squared. Because because as I've said repeatedly, the dot product of two four vectors, and a fortiori the dot product of a four vector with itself, is frame invariant. So the length squared of the four momentum vector is always going to be the mass of the particle squared, even though it'll have different components and different frames.
I will also just quickly write down that with writing E equals gamma m and p, the lowercase p is equal to gamma m v. The forward momentum p is going to be its time component is the energy, that's just p naught, and the spatial components are what I'm writing as the spatial momentum p. So p dot p, which is equal to m squared, is going to be e squared minus p squared. And the that in physical units is also e squared equals p squared c squared plus m squared c fourth. I'm not going to go through the details of that, but it's good to see that expression written down at some point. The point is that there's a nice relationship between the mass, the energy, and the relativistic energy and the relativistic momentum.
That's a key point I want to mention before moving on. But before I go on and talk about photons, are there questions about that? Or rather, what questions? Oh, yeah, excellent, yeah, lot of questions.
Higher up on the working, there was this gamma equals one, and it was to the minus a half.
That's right, yes. Okay. There. So the definition of gamma is it's 1 over square root 1 minus v squared. So that's 1 minus v squared to the power minus a half. Now, if you're if you cast your mind back, have you done Taylor series and Maclaurin series and all that stuff? So you will remember, possibly, or you may not remember, but you can go back and confirm what you've seen before, that 1 plus x to the power n, the Taylor expansion of that, is 1 plus nx plus a half n x squared plus and so on. As a quite general thing. And n doesn't have to be integer. I think that's it's also called the binomial theorem, blah blah blah. There's got a couple of right. It's various special cases have a variety of different names. But the expression just above there is just that applied to the 1 minus v squared to the power minus a half. I think that's right, isn't it? Yeah. One minus a half times v squared. Question there.
So does the order 4 term in that just never matter because it would just be such a small number?
Yes, for v equals small. For v small. Yeah, so this is the sort of thing that you will see again and again in this sort of context and in bits of physics. When something is small, you're also often interested in the so-called leading order behavior. So what is the behavior of something when the next leading order terms can be ignored because they're small. So the expression for the Taylor series is valid for v squared less than 1. Okay. And the thing that's telling us is fairly obviously tells us that gamma goes to 1 when v equals 0, but also is telling us that it goes to 1 quite quickly as v goes to 0. It goes to 1, the deviations from 1 goes as v squared, so when v gets small, gamma gets very close to 1. Yeah, thank you for that. Anything else? Okay. When we were talking about uh, driving the four velocity. You may remember I did it by just differentiating the displacement four vector, delta r, term by term, dr0 by d tau, dr1 by d tau, dr2 by d tau, and so on. Does that work? Oh, and the momentum of our particle was just the mass times that four velocity. Does that work for photons? That particular plan doesn't work for photons because, if you remember, photons always move at the speed of light. And that means that the displacement, they will move as much through time. The time component of the displacement of a photon is always going to be the same as the spatial component of the photon. In other words, which means that the time component squared minus the spatial component squared will be zero. Or photons always move along light-like or null paths. So the four velocity, so by that definition, the four velocity of a photon is always null. So if we were to naively talk about the momentum of a photon in the same way as here, we discover that the photon is always at zero momentum because its mass times a null four vector. So we don't do that. What that is saying is that the prescription that we had for deriving a physically meaningful quantity didn't work in the extreme case where the vector in question was null. What we can instead do, so that for a photon, I'm right, p gamma for a photon that is always null. But if we look back at this expression here, we see that for a massless object, we simply need to have the energy and the momentum equal to each other. So for a massless particle, E squared will be equal to P squared. Massless particle. And what that means in practice is something like the four momentum of our photon will be something like HF, where I have, you've remembered a little bit of quantum mechanics perhaps, to be told that the four moment, that the energy of a photon is Planck's constant times its frequency. So that if we suppose that is the energy of this of a photon with this four momentum, then we know that the say that's moving along the x-axis, then the x component must be the same value in order that the inner product of this four vector with itself end up being null. So we can, by this means, talk sensibly about the four momentum of a massless particle moving at the speed of light in the way that we can't, we couldn't with the prescription before. There's not a lot I can really say about that. That is a thing. Okay. We are making good progress here. So that's before we move on to the next section, are there things, wrapping up things to say about four momentum? Okay. So what other things do we have? There's that. Oh, yes. So that should have a... if that's wrong, it's been wrong for a very long time. Those should be V's in there. Gamma V1, M1, V1. I think I've written the V1s, not wanted to write the second time, whatever. So that's incorrect, and as expression 7.2, as it 7.2B. Now let's look at the slightly simpler situation where two particles collide and form a single outbound particle. Perhaps they collide and it bounces off into the white blue yonder, perhaps it stays at rest or something. Two particles arrive and collide. into one particle. And as before, P1 plus P2 will be equal to P3, just four momentum conservation, but four momentum conservation rather than three momentum conservation. Okay. So let us step through this. In each of those cases, right, Pi will be gamma I Mi 1 Vi, where gamma I is just shorthand for gamma of Vi. So that's for I 1, 2, and 3, for the three different particles. Okay? So let's go through some numbers here. And what we're going to do is we're going to assume that these particles are travelling only in the along the x-axis. So that they're incoming one this direction, one direction, and the resulting particle will end up also moving all in the x direction. So I'm going to miss out y and z just to make things easier to write. So let's suppose that M1 and M2 are 8 units of mass. I'm just not going to worry about what the units of the mass are. They're not very big, okay, for particles. And let the first one be travelling at speed 15/17 of the speed of light. And the second one is stationary, okay? So this is a particle, particles who are sitting there, particle one comes in at 15/17 speed of light, hits it, they join together, and we're interested in what the speed of the particle is going along the x-axis afterwards. Okay, you've got the picture, I trust. That means that we can start to look at the if we ask what is the zeroth component of the energy of particle one, that's going to be gamma one M1. If V1 is equal to 15/17, then gamma of V1 will be 17/8. Okay. One of the Pythagorean triples. Why did I pick that odd fraction? Because 8 squared plus 15 squared is 17 squared. One of the Pythagorean triples. Right, nice and easy to do. That means that the zeroth component of particle 1 is 17/8 times the mass of particle 1, which is 17. The x component of particle 1's momentum is gamma 1 m1 v1, which is that times 15/17, as we want. And we can therefore build up the table that's in the notes. I'm not going to write it out. So there, I worked out what the zeroth component of particle one's momentum for vector was, the one component, the x component, the velocity, the gamma factor, and notice that the mass, the length squared of that four vector is 17 squared minus 15 squared is the zeroth component minus the spatial component, which is 8 squared, the square root of that is 8. So the mass of this particle is still 8, as you would expect. We do the same thing, same calculation. I'm not going to go through the steps. Same calculation for the particle that's at rest. Then its V is 0, so its gamma is 1. So E equals gamma m for particle 2 is m equals 8 times 1, so it's 8. The velocity of that particle is 0, so the spatial component of the forward momentum is 0. So the forward momentum x, t and the x components are 8, 0. Velocity is 0, gamma is 1, and 8 squared minus 0 is 8 squared. Square root of that is 8. So again, the particles, the mass is correct. What about the particle 3? We can now work out what the energy momentum of the particle, outgoing particle is, just by conserving momentum. So here, the zeroth component of particle 3 is 17 plus 8. It's just the sum of the zeroth components of the incoming particles. 17 plus 8 is 25. 15 plus 0 is 15. So the outgoing particle has four momentum 25, 15. And then these from that, we know that looking at this expression here, that Vi is equal to P, the one component divided by the zero component for each particle. So the velocity of this particle is 15 over 25, 3/5, which gives us the gamma factor. And to find out the length of this four vector, we have 25 squared minus 15 squared, which is 20 squared. And so we've filled out the rest of the table. Now, there are a couple of points to make here. I'll make these points again at the beginning of the next lecture, just because they're quite important. So the two incoming particles have four momenta which have the same length. So they're the same energy momentum in both cases. Now that may seem surprising, since one of them is moving and the other one isn't. But since the length of the energy momentum vector is frame invariant, it should be the case no matter what frames we pick. So it has to be the same in all frames. So in the frame with of particle 1, it's particle 2 that's moving. So in the frame of particle 1, it's particle 2 that is moving fast. So therefore, it should not be surprising that in both cases, the energy momentum of the two particles is the same, of two incoming particles is the same, even though in the frame, in our lab frame, only one of them is moving. So the energy momentum is, the total length of energy momentum vector, the squared length, is the mass of the particle. It doesn't reflect how fast the particle is moving. The direction of the four momentum vector reflects how fast the particle is moving in your frame, but that's because the components are frame dependent. And you change frames, you'll have different components. The mass, the length of this of the outgoing particle, is not the sum of the ingoing particles. It's not 16. Because mass, or the length of the four vector, is not a thing that's conserved in collisions. The length of the four vector, the total amount of energy momentum that the particle has, is frame independent, meaning it's the same in all frames, but it's not conserved, meaning it stays the same through a collision. Whereas the components of the four momentum are conserved, meaning they stay the same through a collision, but they're not frame independent. They are different frames. Okay, so 20 is not 8 plus 8. Oh yeah, and that's the third point. So m squared, the length of the four vector, is frame invariant but not conserved. The individual components are conserved but not frame invariant. And I'll pick up there next time.